European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, Saeed Pariza here. We'll kick things off here in the UK. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that COVID-19 deaths over the winter could be twice as high as the first wave. 23,000 people tested positive Sunday and 162 lost their lives. Number 10 has informed the public that in England, the cure system is to be ditched as of Thursday, with the country entering its second national lockdown. Bianca Rahimi reports on the new restrictions and the mounting criticism of the government.
Faced with these latest figures, there is no alternative but to take further action at a national level. I believe it was right to try every possible option to get this virus under control at a local level with strong local action and strong local leadership. And I reject any suggestion that we are somehow slower in taking measures than our European friends and partners.
Some say this is too little, too late, though, and the lockdown will now have to be longer and harder as a result.
Scientific advisers said were necessary back in September. So the government has delayed and dithered. Just as in the first phase, where they were too slow, they've repeated the same mistake.
MPs will debate and vote on the new measures on Wednesday, with several Conservatives expected to rebel against what they call a disastrous course of action. The British public have been warned, though, that the lockdown could be extended if the restrictions don't yield results, threatening a not very merry Christmas.
If we ensure that all the steps that we're taking now are taken appropriately, we'll have an opportunity in advance of December the 2nd to review the progress that we're making, and in advance of December the 2nd, we can then communicate to those areas where some restrictions may be required, what they will be, and also other areas where we've managed to beat back the virus, we can explain where liberties can be restored.
Meanwhile, 16,000 people in Britain are said to have died because of the restrictions on healthcare brought about by the previous lockdown and following restrictions. It's estimated another 26,000 could die by next March. The government has defended the measures, though, saying many more would have died if the restrictions had not been in place. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, let's get some thoughts on that story. Lembit Opec is a former British MP and the political analyst joining me with his thoughts. Good to have you with us. So we just heard what Mr. Johnson said, that he rejects any suggestion that they have been slow in announcing the lockdown the previous time, this time. What do you think?
He would say that, wouldn't he? In reality, here on this very show, I made it quite clear that the biggest failing isn't choosing a particular strategy, but changing that strategy. I would argue that defending the most vulnerable and letting the rest of us be potentially exposed to it might make sense. But what certainly doesn't work is stop-start, and that's what we've got here. And if it's right to have a lockdown now, it would have been right to have a lockdown a month ago as well. So Prime Minister's defending his position. Incidentally, I don't think Labour would have done any better. I don't have much faith that Keir Starmer's got a better strategy. He's sniping from the sidelines. But as far as the question you're concerned applies, yes, we should have done it sooner, and it will cost lives because we didn't.
And, well, you've tested positive for COVID. I wonder, I think we can see signs of it right now as we look at you. First of all, how are you holding up, and has the virus changed your view with regards to a national lockdown?
Yeah, the truth is I feel terrible. I've got a fever, I've got a searing headache, my muscles are sore. It's changed my attitude towards this virus. This is the worst I have felt in terms of illness since I had dysentery 25 years ago. It's that serious, and that also is potentially fatal. Just in terms of the other question, has it changed my view about lockdown? Well, in a sense, I feel there is more immediacy. Having experienced it and experiencing now, I don't know how long I'm going to be ill. I know that this, I can see why this is going to kill people. I'm 55, I'm reasonably healthy, and it's knocked me out. If you told me to come to the studio today, of course I'm not allowed to, it's illegal, I would have turned it down, because I can only walk from the other room to here, and then I have to rest again. So, yes, I think it's persuasive to say until we have a vaccine, we have to have a lockdown, given the fact that the government walked away from herd immunity in the first place.
And, Limbert, apart from the human cost that they're trying perhaps to prevent by imposing this lockdown, there is the financial cost of shutting down the country. Will the UK economy be able to survive this lockdown, especially if it's extended beyond the December 2nd time that they're going to bring the country back out of lockdown?
The UK economy will survive, but in what state? It seems to me we're bound to have another contraction. And maybe that's a price worth paying. If tens of thousands of price already, say, we had to call an ambulance last night for my mother-in-law at 4 in the morning. And that really focuses me, keep touching on your previous question, the mission here is to save lives. But maybe we can, have a high threat. We identify who's genuine. We let the rest take the chances if they choose to. And then we can save the economy to an extent as well. Where will we be in 2 months' time? Further recession, probably another 100,000 million in debt, or potentially more. I was right the last time I made these predictions on the show. I hope I'm not right again, but I can't see any alternative. My one plea to the government is don't keep changing strategy, because that way, whatever you do, you'll lose.
All right. Thank you very much, Limbert Opec, former MP and political commentator. Thanks for coming on. Moving on now, as Europe continues to grapple with the second wave of COVID, protesters are holding rallies across the block to denounce the lack of financial help from their governments. In Italy, hundreds of business owners have marched in Rome to ask for financial support from the government.
If the government closes us, we need to receive an income. The government should give financial support to the people who have to choose whether to work or get sick.
In Spain, protesters have run riot in the northern city of La Borneo hours after the government declared a state of national emergency. Video footage of the chaos showed demonstrators throwing stones and looting stores. The country's prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, condemned the violence and described their actions as intolerable. To other news, as anger continues to spread over insults against the Prophet Muhammad in France, the country's president, Emmanuel Macron, takes to Arabic language airwaves in a bid to placate critics and dampen growing anti-France sentiments.
When we talk about cartoons, many newspapers and magazines, including Charlie Hebdo, have caricatured the Christian God, the Jewish religion, rabbis, and so on. They have also caricatured Prophet Muhammad and the Muslim religion. I understand the feelings that stir up. My role is to calm things down, but to also protect freedom of speech. I understand and respect that one might be shocked by these cartoons, but I will never accept physical violence as a response.
France has seen a worrying spike in targeted violence, with the latest attack coming Friday, with an Orthodox priest who was shot and injured in the city of Lyon. Macron has faced criticism for stoking tensions prior to this latest interview. In response, a growing list of Muslim-majority countries are calling for a boycott of French products. Let's find out how social media has reacted to that story. Robert Carter joins me now with all the details. Robert?
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously, global Muslim outrage has continued well into this week, with huge protests taking place in Bangladesh and also Pakistan, again expressing deep outrage and condemnation of France and its anti-Muslim campaign, but also of the French President Emmanuel Macron following his statements over the weekend, where he, according to Western media, attempted to soften his rhetoric to try and reach out to the global Muslim community amid the ongoing outrage, the call to boycott French products, which has been a very successful campaign on social media over the past week or so. But I'm here to say that actually, if you listen through what the French president was saying during his speech, he still not only defended the so-called freedom of speech to attack Islam and its holiest figures, but also he renewed his criticism of Islam and also of French Muslims. And I have a little clip from his speech to a journalist, which I'll play out now just to give you an example.
Ils enseignent qu'il ne faut pas respecter la France.
They teach that we must not respect France or French law, and that we must somehow get out of these laws. They teach that women are not equal to men. They teach that little girls should not have the same rights as little boys. Not our values. We believe in enlightenment and that women have the same rights as men.
That didn't sound like an apology, Robert. Tell us what social media has been saying about this.
Absolutely. So obviously, a lot of people have realized that despite the fact that Macron claims that he's reaching out to Muslims, he's not demonizing all of Islam and all Muslims. As you heard from the comments there, he still believes that French society is more enlightened than Muslim society. And he added further on that if Muslims don't agree with the way France is conducting itself at the moment, they should essentially leave and go and practice Islam somewhere else, which is essentially an invitation to French Muslims to get out and leave if they don't like the so-called persecution. That's been reflected on social media. Let's go to the first tweet I have, which has expressed criticism. It says, from Abdullah here, it says that Macron should have taken the chance to apologize and put this all to bed once and for all. He decided not to, but I think he is getting scared. Then the next comment I have is from YouTube, again a platform where there's been a lot of criticism of Macron expressed. The first YouTube comment I have says that he is a president with a barber's brain. His head needs beating with shoes to bring it into order. This is freedom of speech, isn't it? So again, a little play on the whole idea of, well, if Macron is going to defend freedom of speech, surely he should be defending the right to criticize him as well. And then the final YouTube comment I have is from Noura, who says, salam to everyone. Indeed, they can't stop Muslims. Macron wants to make it acceptable to insult or abuse Muslims in any way, but when it comes to criticism of Macron himself or the French flag, for example, it's banned. Why did France remove its diplomat from Turkey, for example? Erdogan was expressing free speech, referencing Erdogan's recent insults.
Exactly. Let's move on to your second story. Tell us why Palestinians are suing the British government, Robert.
Absolutely. So today is actually the 103rd anniversary of the historical Balfour Declaration, which was essentially a document signed by the British Foreign Secretary at the time, over 100 years ago now, Sir Arthur Balfour, who basically got the ball rolling in the creation of the of Israel. You know, the colonialist project, which is essentially stealing and occupying Palestinian land. So this anniversary represents the long, over 100 year legacy of brutal colonialist projects which were started by the British, which of course has led to misery for the Palestinians ever since. So obviously, anyone who doesn't know very quickly, Arthur Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary at the time, this over 100 years ago during World War One, and even before Britain invaded and occupied Palestine after defeating the Ottomans during that war, Britain had essentially signed a secret deal with a Zionist political movement here in the UK, pledging that they would create or seek to create a Jewish homeland, as they called it. But obviously,
Jewish
that was
homeland.
On a...
Robert, I hate to cut you off, but we're fast running out of time for this segment. Tell us what social media has been saying about this story.
Absolutely. So obviously, a lot of criticism, as you can imagine, an attempt by Palestinian activists to raise this issue online. So the first one I have from Enos says that, yes, you have to remember your savagery, how you killed Palestine, displaced Palestinians and destroyed their homes. Also, you have to remember the ethnic cleansing. Shame on you, referring to the UK here. And then the second tweet I have is from Nawal, who again is criticizing, saying that what is the point of apologizing? The damage is done and we cannot forgive. Too late after all the suffering of Palestinians that has taken place and is still taking place until today.
Right, we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thank you. Let's take a look at some other stories. Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, says Armenia has admitted defeat in the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh by requesting help from Russia. He promised his forces would go to the end should negotiations fail to result in an agreement that would see ethnic Armenian forces withdraw from Nagorno-Karabakh. In response, Russia's foreign ministry has said it would provide all assistance required should the conflict spill onto the territory of Armenia. Russian authorities estimate the conflict has so far resulted in the deaths of 5,000 troops and civilians from both sides. Hundreds of people have been sheltering in tents after last week's powerful earthquake near Turkey's Aegean coast, which also hit a number of Greek islands. More than 3,000 tents and 13,000 beds have been supplied to provide temporary shelter as rescuers continue to look for survivors. Earlier, a 3-year-old girl was pulled from the rubble 65 hours after the magnitude 6.9 quake. So far, 76 people have lost their lives, with close to 1,000 people injured. Police violence and deaths in custody in the UK is once again under the spotlight as the United Family and Friends campaign seeks to raise the issue of ongoing injustices experienced by many families at the hands of the state. Richard Sedan brings us this update.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was 6 times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." He had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted. You do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
The justification for black deaths in custody and the rationale behind it, you know, is all developed within the sort of racist context of a white privilege that assumes that white people can never be guilty of any sin when it comes to inflicting violence against black people. And that's an attitude and a lived experience we've lived with since we were on the plantations, you know, way back in the 17th century. And it's continued from that day right up until this day.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold. Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
On to the U.S. elections now and how the country is bracing itself for election night, mass protests and riots. For the details, let's bring in Robert Inlakesh. Robert, tell us what's going on.
Well, regardless of which candidate actually wins, it is projected that there will be violence on the streets of many of the different cities in the United States. And of course, we know that there are a number of different militia groups, right-wing militia groups, which are ready to go in favor of Trump. We've already sort of seen a taste of what they're capable of on the streets. And on top of that as well, we have this whole entire situation, the flames of it all fanned by Donald Trump by calling a lot of leftist protesters who come out onto the streets and end up getting into scuffles and attacking right-wing people, describing them as Antifa and BLM terrorists. So when these people are being described as terrorists, of course, this is really exacerbating the situation. Right now, it's very tense, but it is expected that the elections, on election night or when the election results are coming in, that this election is going to be hotly contested regardless of what the actual
Watching from outside,
are.
Robert, it looks like a powder keg waiting to explode, but we'll see how that will go down. Bring us the online conversation of this.
So we got two comments here, one from each side of the argument. First one here we have is from an account called Trump Lies, People Die. They say, dangerous Donald Trump is riling up his base for disruptions, riots if he doesn't win the election on Tuesday. White supremacist, radical right-wing militias, Proud Boy, etc. will likely cause serious problems like on this bridge in New York today. I'm really worried and afraid. We have another one here as well by a user called Danny Black who says that the left in 2020, vandalism, arson, murder, assaults, looting, statues pulled down, people dragged from cars, dinners in restaurants, forced to kneel or put their fists in the air. Also, the left in 2020, Trump's militias are going to kick off if he loses.
Well, that one tweet covers a lot of ground, doesn't it, Robert? Your second story, Twitter has suspended the accounts of dozens of Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activists. Tell us why.
Well, actually, there was a request which was put in from the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs. The regime itself had requested through its ministry to Twitter that they take down 170 Palestinian accounts, pro-Palestine accounts, which accused, of course, of being fake accounts. However, that's not been the case. A lot of prominent Palestinians, including from in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, have had their accounts taken down. Also, on top of this, Palestinian media accounts, which are writing in English, have been taken down, such as Shihab Agency, which was taken down just yesterday from Twitter, their English handle. And also, Quds News has been taken down. Many different accounts have been taken down. Very legitimate organizations which are bringing Palestinian perspective. And that's what we see, that they are attacking the Palestinian perspective, Palestinian voices, and making sure they delegitimize the message of Palestinians so that they can dehumanize them and justify the Israeli crimes against humanity committed against the Palestinian people.
Well, we're talking about Twitter suspending those accounts. Bring us some tweets on this story.
The first one we have here commenting on this is from an account called Cynthia Wilson, who says, Twitter aims to at annihilating the Palestinian narrative and deleting all stuff related to Palestine. Hashtag Twitter censors Palestine. Got another one here as well who says that Twitter's suspension of Palestinian accounts is a blatant violation that aims to suppress the Palestinian content and hide a narrative that exposes the real face of the Israeli occupation. Again, with the same hashtag there.
Hashtag seems to be taking off, Robert. Robert Inlakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast. We'll be right back.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Reminders of Being Just. Dear brothers and sisters, justice is something that every human being looks up to. Justice is something that all the societies cherish and value. Islam, being the religion of nature, being that religion which understands our needs as an individual and as a society, has also emphasized on justice. And we said that Islam is a proponent of justice for all. Now, when we speak about justice for all, when it comes to the tyrants and oppressors, of course, when you serve them the justice, this is where they get the punishment. You have to resist against the tyrants and oppressors. There are a few reminders that we would like to give you today about justice. Well, number one is always follow the truth and always judge fairly, even if it is against yourself, your parents, or your relatives. Don't fall for that trap where just because somebody is related to me, I become biased and I try to somehow, you know, make things easier for that person when it comes to justice and serving justice. Number two, if you're given some responsibility, do not make your enmity against a certain person, or if you're given some responsibility, do not make your enmity against a certain person a reason to oppress and take others' rights. Allah, the Glorified, has said, do not let hatred for a people incite you into not being just. Be just. This is closer to righteousness. This is Surah Al-Ma'idah, chapter Al-Ma'idah, verse number 8. So, brothers and sisters, we know our responsibilities are clearly laid out by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We cannot be unjust towards anyone, even if they are our enemies. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today, we are giving you some reminders of being just. Well, we went over two of them. We're going to give you two more. The third one is, do not oppress anyone, no matter what the reason may be or whoever the person may be, and give everyone their rights. In Islam, even if you're in a battlefield, the enemy has rights. You cannot just go with this phrase of everything being fair in war and love. This is not something what Islam believes in or prescribes. No, we have rules. Islam is based on the principle of justice, rules of engagement, even in the battlefield. Even with the staunchest of your enemy, we're not supposed to just oppress them and not give them their rights and be unjust. The fourth one is follow the example of Prophet and be wise and just with your family and be fair when dividing things between your children. Moreover, teach them to follow the Prophet's guidance concerning being just. This is again one of the reminders that sometimes we tend to forget. It's our responsibility to make this trait a special trait in human society. We need to establish justice in human society. We need to teach our kids and our offsprings and our next generation the importance of justice and how Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, they prevailed justice. They wanted to see justice ruling the societies. So this is our responsibility to carry this message, disseminate this message, and inshallah get to a point where we can implement justice in our societies. So the importance of justice is, very highlighted in Islam, and hence we are supposed to and expected to follow the guidelines of Islam and being just. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Dear listeners, the article you are about to hear has been authored by Asaka Bandraj and carries the title The Quest for a Treaty Prohibiting Nuclear Weapons. Stay tuned, please. Of all the weapons created throughout human history, nuclear weapons are the most destructive and indiscriminate. They are capable of causing enormous devastation involving uniquely persistent, spreading, genetically damaging radioactive fallout, whereas a single nuclear bomb that detonated over a large city could kill millions of people. The deployment of tens or hundreds of them could disrupt the global climate, creating intolerable conditions for both humans and other species. The Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, commonly known as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was adopted in 1970 with the objectives of halting the adoption of these weapons and disarming those that already existed. The NPT recognized five states as nuclear weapon states. In order of acquisition, they are the US, Russia, the UK, France, and China. The NPT has had limited success in curtailing nuclear weapons proliferation, and the five recognized nuclear weapons states have also shown a reluctance to disarm. Since the adoption of the NPT, three more states, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, have conducted overt nuclear tests. North Korea, which had been a party to the NPT, withdrew in 2003, while the Zionist regime, which is known to have nuclear weapons, does not acknowledge it. Five more states, including Belgium, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and Turkey, also host U.S. nuclear weapons. 26 other countries endorsed the possession and use of nuclear weapons on their behalf in accordance with defense alliances, including the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Despite the NPT's calls for a diminishing role for nuclear weapons in security policies, the five declared nuclear weapon states have maintained huge stockpiles, leading critics to question the legitimacy and enforcement capacity of the treaty. U.S. plans to develop new weapons, including anti-ballistic missiles, earth-penetrating bunker busters, and new small bombs, have been of particular concern. Countries like New Zealand also see the NPT's inability to subject the Israeli regime to the treaty's restrictions as a major problem. As geopolitical conflicts intensify, nuclear weapon states continue to modernize and rearm their arsenals. The danger of a limited nuclear war, if not a full-scale one, in the near future is real. Among those leading the movement to ban nuclear weapons are the few remaining victims of the U.S. nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Meanwhile, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, was adopted at the United Nations on July 7, 2017, with the support of 122 nations. The TPNW, also known as the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty, is the first legally binding international agreement comprehensively to prohibit nuclear weapons and to seek their total elimination. Article 1 of the Treaty on Prohibitions states that each state party undertakes never under any circumstances to do the following: develop, test, produce, manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess, or stockpile nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, transfer to any recipient whatsoever nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, or control over such weapons or explosive devices directly or indirectly, receive the transfer of or control over nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices directly or indirectly, use or threaten to use nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, assist, encourage, or induce in any way anyone to engage in an activity prohibited to a state party under this treaty, seek or receive any assistance in any way from anyone to engage in any activity prohibited to a state party under this treaty, allow any stationing, installation, or deployment of any nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices in its territory or at any place under its jurisdiction or control. For the TPNW to come into effect, 50 countries must sign and ratify the treaty. As of October 23rd, 84 states had signed and 49 had ratified or acceded to it. Only one more state is needed to complete ratification. A mere 90 days after the 50th ratification, the TPNW will enter force as international law, binding on countries that have ratified it. In the meantime, stating that it won't sign the TPNW, U.S. President Donald Trump's administration continues to move away from international agreements to curtail nuclear weapons. On August 2, 2019, the Trump administration officially withdrew from 1987 Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty between the United States and Russia. The U.S. and Russia are currently negotiating an extension of the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or a New START, the only remaining treaty placing limits on the growth of the world's two largest nuclear arsenals. New START is set to expire on February 5, 2021. Meanwhile, the United States is urging countries that have ratified the TPNW to withdraw their support as the pact nears the 50 ratifications. The TPNW supporters believe that the 50th ratification needed to bring it into effect could happen anytime soon. However, a recent letter sent by the Trump administration to signatories and obtained by the Associated Press states that the five original nuclear powers, including the US, Russia, China, Britain, and France, and America's NATO allies, stand unified in our opposition to the potential repercussions of TPNW. The letter also states that the TPNW is detrimental to the objectives of NPT, claimed to be the cornerstone of global non-proliferation efforts. It further says to the countries that have ratified the TPNW, "Although we recognize your sovereign right to ratify or accede to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, we believe that you have made a strategic error and should withdraw your instrument of ratification or accession." Beatrice Finn, the executive director of International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the sponsor of TPNW, responded by saying that the Trump administration is pressuring countries to withdraw from a United Nations-backed disarmament treaty is an unprecedented action in international relations. Shows how fearful they are of the treaty's impact and growing support. It should be noted that there is no fundamental difference between the Democratic and Republican parties on the U.S. foreign policy and U.S. militarism. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has affirmed support for continuation of U.S. military and imperial agendas. In the meantime, small and medium-sized countries have joined the TPNW to avoid possible nuclear build-ups and conflagrations on their soil. Indeed, the vast majority of countries that have ratified the TPNW thus far are small states struggling to maintain their neutrality from nuclear-armed states.
In this day and age, for this generation, with all of the resources that you have at your disposal that your predecessors did not have, but you have now, the means to communicate across some very serious divides and make the decisions to eradicate the artificial barriers that have been erected for us and begin to carve out some new ground based on the history of Islam in America and in the African-American Muslim community and the struggles that were fought for our faith and the right to name ourselves and to have our faith front and center, to have our faith define who we are. We always sought to have people know who we were by our faith tradition. We certainly could not change the color of our skin, right? But we wanted people to know who we were as a religious community. And this goes back centuries ago. The enslaved Africans who came here, many of them came as Muslims, and they were stripped of their language and their culture, their names, their identities. And we never ask the question, we say, oh, they lost their religion. But in fact, they didn't lose their religion. So we didn't ask the question, well, what happened to those Muslims? Who are they? You know, what became of them? And what happened to them? So I will ask you to take the initiative to do the research yourself and find out who your ancestors are. And they are not just those ancestors that you might be aware of from back home, because many of them came to these shores and settled on this shore. In terms of struggle, we're all in some form of struggle, but we need to get out of the habit of apologizing for who we are and just take the plunge to stand up and be who we are, to challenge the status quo, and that we must do. Otherwise, we are simply complicit in all of the wrongdoing that comes in our name. And we have to be the ones to stand up and say, not in my name. You will not commit atrocities. You will not abuse people. You will not malign people, whether they are Muslims or not, in our names. As active, viable citizens of this land, we have a responsibility. And I say to you that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You have a legacy of a community that has done that and continues to do that consistently. One of the things that I like to share and that really irks me to this day is we see so many images of starving children in Africa. We never broach the subject of Africa as one of the richest, if not the richest, continent on the planet. So my question is why? Why are they starving? Why are they suffering? Where are all the resources? We are people who have had our resources and our wealth usurped, taken from us, stolen from us. And you don't really realize blood, sweat, and tears that went into making, you know, the foundational pieces that went into making this country through the free labor that was contributed by enslaved Africans, many of them who were Muslim. These are histories that you need to know so that when you go out and talk about the degrees that we have, you know, and the wealth that we've accumulated over time, and you entered the class of elites, many of us, you have to know and remember and reach back that there are communities of color, specifically African-American communities, that have paved the way for your ascension into these categories and begin to push back on the obvious atrocities that you see perpetrated every day before you in the name of democracy. You know that many of our children are suffering right here at home. The prison industrial complex, from school, the pipeline to prison, right? Why are young black men and more increasingly young black women targeted and incarcerated? And we have viable research that talks to us about how our children are treated in schools, girls and boys, how they are targets not just by their peers, but by law enforcement at a very early age. The educational system that we've always challenged as African Americans in this country. We early on understood that we had to educate our own children because we knew that they were not going to get the kind of education that they needed to survive and prosper. Well, that still remains as we enter the vaulted halls of the elite universities in this country, the Ivy League communities. We also know that those Ivy League universities are predicated on their involvement in slavery in the early days. So we should never underestimate the power of that kind of legacy, how it continues to influence and carry into the world as we become adults, accomplished professionals, and go out in the world and speak about advancement, liberation, so forth. We need to go back home and create some really serious conversations within our communities about what side of the equation are we on. You know, do we want to be a part of the solution, or are we content to be a part of the problem and reap whatever benefits are given to us as a result of our complicity? So that is not the way of viable Muslim. We are always pushing for a greater liberty for everyone, including our own, but never just our own, because when we push for the greater community, our Muslim community is part of that as well. So I say also younger people need to have a seat at the table from the beginning so that we can hear their voices and plan for their future. And I would like to request that we begin to reach out to the Native American community. We didn't just land here, you know. These people, they've been here for a while. And when we are facing climate change, these are the communities that we need to be embracing and learning from. We have a lot of work to do, but we have a lot of also unrealized allies in the world. So to get out of our silos, to be bold enough to challenge the status quo. Don't go along with what we know is unjust because it's in our own perceived interest, because ultimately it is not in your own best interest. But when we fight for total liberation for everybody. And when we do that, we see that, wow, the world is really, really a beautiful place. And we're all struggling together, and our umbrella gets wider and bigger, and then you can really enjoy the diversity of this great community that we call Islam in America. So we stand ready to stand by you and urge you on to be fierce and bold in your opposition to oppression, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.